We're taking a little trip into the mind on today's edition of Please Explain with a look at psychedelic drugs. Dr. Nicholas Langlitz, Assistant Professor of Medical Anthropology at the New School for Social Research, is here. And we're also talking with Dr. Stephen Ross, Assistant Professor at NYU Medical Center's Departments of Psychiatry and Inpatient Service. And they'll be explaining how psychedelic drugs affect the brain, how hallucinogens work, and the new research into using psychedelic drugs to treat post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and depression. Welcome to our show.
Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having us.
Stephen, which drugs are categorized as psychedelics? Do they all have certain chemical qualities in common?
Well, Schedule I drugs include a broad array of drugs. Many hallucinogens are in there, including the serotonergic hallucinogens like LSD, psilocybin, mescaline. But it also includes opiates such as heroin are in there, and other hallucinogens, drugs like PCP are in there as well. Cannabis is there as well.
But the psychedelics, do they have certain chemical qualities in common? I know the opiates are quite different.
Well, psychedelics is a very broad term, and if you look at hallucinogens, they're typically include the serotonergic ones that have a very similar interaction at a subtype of serotonin receptor, the serotonin 2A receptor they activated. But other people considered drugs like PCP, ketamine to be hallucinogens as well. They definitely are hallucinogens, and they act through a different pathway. They block a subtype of glutamate receptor.
Nicholas, is there a definition, an accepted definition of a psychedelic drug?
Well, I think the term psychedelic already has its own history. So if you look at that from a historical perspective, beforehand, there was more talk about hallucinogens and psychotomimetics, that is, drugs that either generate hallucinations or that mimic psychosis. And that was associated with a particular kind of use in psychiatry, which consisted in using these drugs to model schizophrenic psychosis in healthy subjects in an experimental setting. And then in the 1950s, Humphrey Osmond, who was actually a researcher who was practicing this kind of model psychosis paradigm, entered into a conversation with the writer Aldous Huxley. And in an exchange of letters, they coined the term psychedelic. And it goes along with a very peculiar theory of their action. Huxley believed that the brain actually functioned as a filter and that we're constantly confronted with an abundance of sensory stimulation coming from the environment. And as a biological function, the brain filters out everything that is not directly relevant for our biological survival, including various cues of supernatural realities. And psychedelic means mind manifesting. And what Huxley meant by mind was mind with a capital M, that was some kind of cosmic mind. And the idea was that the intoxication would make the filter break down, and then this cosmic mind would basically enter into your individual mind, and there would be some kind of mystical experience where you fuse with the universe.
Sounds very Jungian to me.
Yeah, there is a lot of Jungianism in the background of the psychedelic discourse.
Now, Stephen, we mentioned the other word is hallucinogen, and that, of course, evokes hallucinations. Are there always hallucinations when these drugs are taken?
No, that's actually a mischaracterization. They cause more illusions, distortion of sensory stimuli that exist externally and that are there, such as walls, breathing, etc. They tend to not cause frank hallucinations. In fact, if you look at drugs that cause real hallucinations within the drug abuse field, take stimulants like methamphetamine and cocaine, they cause frank hallucinations, but we don't classify them as hallucinogens. Alcohol as well can classically, over a long period of time, cause several psychotic types of illnesses, and we don't call them hallucinogens either. So it's a bit of a misnomer.
We're talking.
May I add something?
Yeah.
So the notion of psychedelics emphasizes the ego dissolution dimension of these drugs. So if you think of your ego as a bounded self, then this these boundaries break down, and that's how the either mystical experiences come about, or also more psychotic forms of depersonalization and derealization. And that's basically emphasized by this different term.
We're talking about psychedelic drugs, hallucinogens, whatever word you want to use, on today's Please Explain with Drs. Nicholas Langlitz and Stephen Ross. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Our phone number, by the way, in case you want to give us a call, is 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Well, Nicholas just said that there's a psychotic component here, and I wonder why anybody would want to take a drug to mimic psychoses. You want to deal with that first, Stephen?
Sure. Well, one of the things that we do in our study here at NYU is we exclude people that have psychotic spectrum illness, such as schizophrenia or severe variants of bipolar disorder. Within psychiatry, psychosis is considered a pathological state always. We don't really have a nomenclature to understand very powerful altered states that we would typically be classified as psychosis but have a positive construct to them, or it could be therapeutic. And so I don't think we have a language in the field yet to describe a highly altered state that would be therapeutic.
Now, how many of these drugs are natural? Can be found in nature, and how many of them are manufactured? Nicholas?
Well,
LSD is a man-made...
LSD is a synthetic drug, and then the psilocybin that's used in the studies that are currently conducted is also synthetic psilocybin, even though it originally was derived from psilocybin mushrooms. And then, of course, you have peyote cacti, and you have the ayahuasca vine as a source of DMT. So there are various natural sources for these drugs, but what's being used in science today is mostly synthetic versions. And, of course, one difference between the plant drugs and the synthetic versions is that the synthetic drugs you can dose accurately, so that's a big advantage for scientific studies. And in the plants, there are usually various other compounds as well, which can be for better or worse. So there can be a stronger impact because of that, or can go into a different direction. But
Stephen, LSD is often called acid. Is it an acid?
No, it's. It's a chemical. It's an ergot derivative, discovered by Albert Hofmann while he was looking for treatment for women that had bleeding during pregnancy. But no, it's not acid.
Well, how do these different drugs work in the brain? Do they all have follow similar pathways?
Well, if you look at the serotonergic hallucinogens or classical hallucinogens like LSD and psilocybin, peyote, they all have the same common interaction, and that is they activate a subtype of serotonin receptor, the 2A receptor, and that leads to a very, very powerful effect, and it activates what we think is the spiritual pathway. And we are learning more now that we are wired to have spiritual experience and that there's a neurobiological pathway towards that. And Franz Wollenweider is a neuroscientist in Switzerland who has put patients in fMRI and other brain scanning machines while under the influence of drugs like psilocybin, ketamine, and MDMA. And he's been able to look at which areas of the brain become activated and deactivated during the experience of being on psychedelics. And it's actually between drugs like ketamine and psilocybin, it looks quite similar in terms of the brain pattern. And then if you look at imaging people like Buddhist monks that are reporting peak experiences, this has been done at University of Pennsylvania, the scans start to look very similar to those undergoing a drug-induced psychedelic experience.
Well, since we have these serotonin receptors already in our bodies, it would suggest to me that our bodies have somehow been designed to receive these kinds of drugs. Am I thinking backward here? For example, I understand that the reason the opiates work is because we already have opiates built into our bodies, and when we experience pain, we create our own natural opiates to help us get through that painful moment.
Well, I guess that depends on whether you think of the body as designed for a particular purpose in the first place.
But if it's there, there has to be some reason that it's there.
Well, there is some evidence that there is a little bit of endogenous DMT being produced, but otherwise hallucinogens are mostly coming from the plant realm and are not. There is nothing like an endorphin like hallucinogen.
Now, once we've taken this drug, how long does it last in our body? I assume that varies depending on the drug. But are there ways of being able to overcome them and come out of what word do I want to use? The language here is so difficult, but let's say the LSD high.
Yeah, so, you know, the study we're doing here at NYU, we have a pharmacologic antidote, and if you take it early enough, these are drugs, antipsychotic drugs like Zyprexa. They block the 5-HT2A receptor, so they can actually abort the experience, and if given early enough.
So what Steve and his team are doing for in the context of these therapeutic settings, of course, is also the rationale of model psychosis research, where you basically test unknown compounds for whether they might have any antipsychotic qualities by giving an animal or a human subject first hallucinogen or a psychedelic drug, and then you add the antipsychotic drug, and if it undoes the psychotic qualities of the hallucinogen experience, then you have some indication that this might also work in a schizophrenic patient population.
When I first heard about LSD, it was in an article by an art historian who said that he had taken it under a doctor's supervision, and he had hallucinated Van Eyck paintings because that was his specialty. And I thought, gee, that's great. And then I spoke to some people who'd taken LSD, and they said, well, there is this visual component, but there also are bad trips. There are flashbacks. There are all sorts of other things that would make it not as attractive as that article suggested. Well, first of all, can we address the whole matter of the visual aspect? Why is there such a strong visual component?
Well, you know, in terms of the neuroscience behind that, we're not 100% sure. There's Nicholas had mentioned that we filter out stimuli of the thalamus during these experiences, which is an organ in the brain that filters sensory stimuli to the cortex, stops its inhibiting function, decreases while under the influence, and so you get bombarded with extra stimuli, and there's a concept called synesthesia, where you can hear colors. And so all senses are enhanced, not just visual ones, sound as well, taste even, feeling. So everything about sensation is enhanced in some way, and people have a novel experience of sensory stimuli in ways they weren't tuned to before.
Is LSD the strongest? Would you have just as strong a sensory experience with peyote, with mescaline, with psilocybin?
No, if you were to compare mescaline, psilocybin, and LSD, psilocybin is 10 times more potent than mescaline, and LSD is 10 times more potent than psilocybin. LSD is probably one of the most potent chemicals we have known to man, that in tiny micrograms it produces a very powerful effect, and it has a long half-life. It can last up to 8 to 12 hours, making it much more difficult to put into a research setting, unlike psilocybin, which lasts 4 to 6 hours and is a gentler drug, making it more feasible to put into a research setting.
But, of course, everything is a question of dose as well.
Mm. Yes. Well, but then since I remember in the 60s and 70s, people who seemed to have had serious after effects from taking all that LSD, you have to wonder about whether any dosage is safe for in the laboratory or anywhere else. If you take it under under laboratory conditions with somebody watching you, are you less likely to have a bad trip?
Well, first of all, I mean, no drug is safe, right? I mean, even if you go to the drugstore at the next corner and you buy St. John's Wort, that's not safe either in a total sense. So it the question is always, say, is it safe to use the drug for a certain purpose? And of course, if you basically have no medical issue, the expectations that we have in terms of safety are much higher than if somebody has a serious problem.
If you look at the safety data from the tens of thousands of doses administered to research subjects in the United States and Europe from a 20-year span, the established safety profile when done in a laboratory setting with preparation excluding people with major mental illness, rapport building, is very, very low adverse psychological events. If you look at 100 or so research subjects that have been treated in the United States and Europe in the last decade, not one person became psychotic, needed to be hospitalized. Nobody needed medication to help them during or after the session. Nobody became addicted to the drug. So with careful preparation and done in the right kind of way, the safety profile is very acceptable.
Yeah, Franz Fallenbeider's group in Zurich that was already mentioned has just published a new study on more than 100 subjects that they had in their lab. And there was basically one person in among these 100 subjects who had some lasting psychological problems. But these were probably pre-existing problems that basically came to the fore. And so that bad trip that he had was basically a reason for him to go into psychotherapy and work through those pre-existing problems.
My guests are Drs. Nicholas Langlitz, Assistant Professor of Medical Anthropology at the New School for Social Research, and Dr. Stephen Ross, Assistant Professor at NYU Medical Center, Departments of Psychiatry and Inpatient Service. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll be taking your calls at 646-829-3985. That's 646-829-3985. Or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org.
One pill makes you larger, and one pill makes you small. And the ones that mother gives you don't do anything.
Feel like we're returning to the 60s on the show, Leonard Lopate Show. Actually, please explain a look at psychedelic drugs with Dr. Nicholas Langlitz of the New School and Dr. Stephen Ross of NYU Medical Center. And we're taking your calls at 646-829-3985. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And let's go right to our first caller, Greg from Armonk. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I have a quick question. I'm a fairly avid drug user, I currently was, and I had taken ecstasy, and I had a severely adverse effect to it. I was immediately plunged into depression. It was quite an intense experience, to say the least. And the people around me were taking the same pill I took, so I knew it wasn't something with the pill. And I was just wondering why that may be, why, you know, everyone else was experiencing this great euphoria, and I was just plunged into depression.
And I want to talk a bit more about ecstasy. Was it MDMA? Is that its other name? After we finish discussing this, which one of you wants to address the listener's call?
Well, I mean, if I should respond to that from the perspective of a medical anthropologist, I would say that, of course, drug effects, especially the effects of psychedelic drugs, have a lot to do with set and setting. That is to say, with the expectations, with the cultural background, with the mood that a subject is in, as well as with the environment of the drug experience. So the environment of that drug experience seems to have been the same for everybody involved. But if there was something going on in the person's life beforehand that might have led to an adverse drug reaction, that might be one reason. And the other is pharmacogenetics. We all differ genetically and have different responses to different drugs.
Had you taken ecstasy before, Greg?
Yeah, I had. In fact, I was kind of frustrated with the experience. So beyond that first time I took it, maybe three or four times after. At the time, I was in a very good mood. I didn't have any problems. I mean, I've taken plenty of psychedelics. I've taken mushrooms. I've taken acid and even DMT, which is fairly hard to get a hold of.
Maybe you've just taken too many of them.
Yeah, I mean, that had occurred to me, but this is actually prior to taking acid and things like that. It was at a fairly quiet time. I mean, the setting seemed right and everything
okay,
like
well,
that.
But this is not an unusual situation. A bunch of people take any kind of drug, and one person has a bad experience, others having a fabulous time. You're suggesting, Nicholas, that it could be just where he was, where his body was chemically at that moment?
Well, I guess the other problem that might have to do with it is that this was probably MDMA bought on the black market. And, of course, there is no quality controls for productions of drugs that come out on the black market. So you can't be sure that one pill is exactly like the other.
Well, Stephen, we've heard a lot of warnings against MDMA, but isn't it being used therapeutically, especially to treat PTSD?
That's right. In fact, the first publication ever with MDMA to treat PTSD recently occurred in the journal Psychopharmacology, a British journal, and it was a pilot study of 12 patients with PTSD. And I believe it may have included one that was a war veteran, and it was a double-blind, placebo-controlled trial, the right kind of clinical experimental paradigm that you would need, and it showed a very significant treatment effect, and it was able to establish safety in terms of the small sample. And there are other studies now. There's a new study starting that's looking at MDMA specifically in war veterans down in South Carolina.
Now, why would it have a positive effect if it has a very different kind of a, it's when it's used recreationally, it's not used for anything like PTSD?
Well, it's an unusual drug in that it has the ability to enhance empathic states, probably related to its release of oxytocin, which is released and related to mother-child bonding. And so people, you know, and in all of these studies, you don't just get the drug and have some experience, and that's what is therapeutic. In many ways, these drugs are added to psychotherapy. And so these are traumatized individuals who develop a rapport with two caring treatment providers, and then they take a drug that puts them in a state where they're very attached to other people. It's a drug that causes a diminution of anxiety, usually, and causes people to feel open. And what happens in these sessions is that people go back and can talk about the traumatic event and re-experience it in a different way and have a different kind of memory that, and again, this is speculative, that potentially can replace the more traumatic memory. And we know that PTSD in many ways has to do with difficult memories being stored in a part of the brain called the amygdala. And interestingly, MDMA diminishes amygdaloid activity. And so we're trying to speculate from both biological and other mechanisms why it may work. We don't know right now, but much more research needs to be done.
Yeah. Is that why mushrooms are also being used to treat anxiety and depression? Do they have a similar effect?
They're actually different. MDMA is not a classical hallucinogen, and it does not activate the serotonin 2A receptor and tends to not cause mystical experiences, unlike psilocybin. And its mechanism of action is different. It's partially an amphetamine and also acts on the serotonin system. But we think the mechanism of psilocybin is different from MDMA. And its effects, whether it's biological or the psycho-spiritual mystical properties, we think are what's causing the diminution of anxiety.
A listener wonders about psilocybin mushrooms. They cause stomach upset and wonders whether they have a negative effect on the body.
Well, it depends if, you know, there are several alkaloids in psilocybin mushrooms in addition to the psychoactive one, which is psilocybin. What we're finding here in experimental settings so far, pure synthetic psilocybin, we haven't had anyone that's had any GI distress. But certainly with all psychedelics, that can be a transient component. And actually with the drug ayahuasca that Nicholas mentioned earlier, that drug can really cause a lot of nausea and vomiting, and it's variable between people, but that is a side effect, physical side effect.
A listener asks, I throw this out to both of you, does your age at the time of taking a psychedelic drug have any effect on your experience? I mean, if you're, let's say you're more psychologically mature, will you be able to handle it better than if you're 14 or 15 years old?
Certainly. I mean, if you are in an emotionally unstable state, which a lot of young people are in, going through a period of storm and stress, then it's a bigger challenge to disrupt that with a drug than if you are settled.
We have heard over the years that it causes chromosome damage. Has that been proven?
That has been disproven.
Let's take a call from Eddie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. Eddie.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay.
Hi, one of your guests earlier was mentioning, you know, the sort of like cosmic effect on the ego, and I guess I just was curious a little bit. You know, Cary Grant famously did a course of therapy with LSD and, you know, swears by the beneficial effects it had on his relationships. And I just was curious to hear a little bit more about the beneficial history of the therapeutic use of these you know, these drugs.
Before they were made illegal or all along?
Yes. I mean, I guess obviously that's when the public sort of would have been, you know, able to be a sort of larger guinea pig as opposed to just sort of, you know, isolated scientific experiments. But yeah, I mean, you know, sort of before they were legalized, they were sort of glorified for their positive effects. And I just would like to, I'm just curious.
Well,
sort of
Cary Grant contributed.
What the mechanisms were?
Cary Grant contributed significantly to that by claiming that women, young women, had never been as attracted to him as after he had taken LSD, so that certainly did its job in terms of advocating the drug use.
Well, the caller suggested that there was a lot of positive talk, but there was also a lot of negative talk, especially when the CIA gave LSD to soldiers, was it, or to subjects without telling them? So also, the military did that.
And well, the CIA also gave LSD to their own agents, basically to prepare them for the possibility that the enemy might spike their drinks, and they should be prepared for that. Of course, they had very bad trips because they didn't know what was going on. Nobody was telling them. All of a sudden, they just started to hallucinate, and that's scary. So they certainly had the very bad experiences that you can also get.
Well, we've heard about a lot of bad experiences, but I'm getting the feeling that the two of you are saying that under certain circumstances, these drugs, like thalidomide, which of course caused some terrible things to happen, can have positive uses. Is that what you're saying, Stephen?
Well, we have to eventually look at the data, but if you look now, there's a reemergence of interest in these agents in places like Johns Hopkins, UCLA, NYU, Harvard, University of Arizona, University of New Mexico, very serious scientists who are interested in therapeutic potential. In the last month, we had three articles that were published in very prestigious psychiatric journals, one on ketamine and bipolar depression, the MDMA-PTSD study, and a couple of weeks ago, psilocybin to treat anxiety associated with terminal cancer. So if we continue to do research in the proper modern paradigm and we continue to show safety and efficacy as we move forward and large samples of people have been treated, then I think we're able to say more likely that this is a true therapeutic effect. But certainly so far, it seems like there's something therapeutic going on.
Nancy from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air. And Nancy, I don't know where Nancy is from. Oh, from Maywood,
it's
New Jersey.
Maywood.
Hi. Hi, Nancy. You want to do a follow-up to that?
Yeah, that actually was the answer to my question. I was going to ask, with all the research being done, I'm a huge MAP supporter, and all of these wonderful people doing research and proving time and time again that there's really more benefit than there is, you know, a detriment to a patient who may need this. How come it is still on Schedule 1, and what can we do, if anything, to help, you know, I guess support the cause?
Well, I guess the answer is primarily that the studies that have so far been done are still at too exploratory a stage for the FDA to accept medical use. an established medical use. And basically, the direction into which these therapeutic studies are going is that once one of these uses has been established, these substances will be moved out of Schedule 1, and that will have a much bigger impact than just the one medical application, but it also leads to a different regulatory situation, which will make it easier for other researchers to basically invent other medical uses, and will, of course, also generate a kind of public support for these substances.
Anna on Facebook asks, does LSD really stay in your spinal fluid for years after you take it?
No, it doesn't.
But that's one of the things that we have heard over the years. Is that a problem in dealing with these drugs, that there has just been so much misinformation disseminated about them, largely by people who just don't want us to take these drugs?
Well, I guess misinformation has been spread by all sides in this debate. Polarized, and Timothy Leary spread as much misinformation as the Nixon administration did. But, yeah, of course, that's a big problem.
You want to add to that, Stephen? Because we're running out of time.
I think that there's starting to be a culture shift. The government has allowed the reemergence of this research since the early 90s, and they continue to be open to it through the FDA process. And the DEA is open to allowing these studies to happen. Institutions are allowing them to happen. Our process here at NYU is very eye-opening for me.
I have to leave it there, unfortunately. Yeah. Dr. Stephen Ross, assistant professor at NYU Medical Center, and Dr. Nicholas Langlitz, assistant professor of medical anthropology at the New School for Social Research. Thank you both so much for being on today's Please Explain.
Thank you.
Thank you.